And we are back at STR Asks in studio. My name's John Noyes. I'm one of the newer speakers with Stand to Reason, and I'm here with Greg Kokel, and we want to answer everybody's questions. And how are you doing today, Greg?
Okay, buddy.
All right. Let's dive in. This first question, I love his name. It's Think McFly. And he has sent us this question. In light of the coronavirus pandemic, what's the best way to respond to skeptics that say, your God cannot stop the COVID-19 pandemic, and when a cure is found, it's not an answer to prayers. It's the work of doctors and scientists that deserve all the credit.
Yeah.
How would you answer that?
Well, a couple things come to mind. First of all, to say that God cannot stop it is a pretty strong claim. Why would they say that God cannot stop it? And the reason they're saying God cannot stop it is because they think that God hasn't stopped it, okay? But there is no way of anybody knowing whether God has intervened in the circumstance or not. What tragedies has God intervened on that didn't happen? Well, the ones that didn't happen today, one could say. Now, that's kind of an argument from silence, but the point is, so is the objection.
Yeah.
This is not something we have any access to be able to say anything meaningful about. And this, probably coming from a skeptic or an atheist of some sort, seems to be an indictment against God. Well, see, God cannot cause whatever health crisis one looks at, whether it's malaria or tuberculosis or cancer or whatever. God can't stop that. Really? What makes you think that God can't stop it? Well, he didn't stop it, did he? Well, you don't know what he didn't stop. He didn't stop it entirely, but you don't know what he didn't stop, because whatever he did stop, you won't know was there or would have happened, is the point I'm making.
Yeah.
Okay. So a person, now this obviously doesn't prove anything about God. What it is meant to show is that that this kind of charge does not prove anything against God. Okay? We don't know what God has done and what he hasn't done. And there is a difference between not being able to do something and choosing not to intervene. So it could be that God has chosen not to intervene. Well, why would he do that? Well, I don't know. He hasn't told me. But I'll give you a good analog on this. Do you remember that, John, do you remember that movie, Bruce Almighty?
I do.
Who was the,
Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey.
And Morgan Freeman was
Morgan
God.
Morgan Freeman was God.
He makes a wonderful God.
And so what God, Morgan Freeman, did is he gave Jim Carrey the opportunity to be God for a day. And so when the prayer requests came in, which he got on his computer, you've got mail, you know, kind of thing. And he just went and he answered yes to all of the requests. And what was very interesting, this is the just about the first time, certainly in my immediate memory, when Hollywood did something profound and insightful theologically. In other words, what they showed is if every prayer got answered the way we ask for it to be answered, lots of chaos can result. And this is what ended up happening in the story.
Yeah.
They played this theme out. So what this movie demonstrates is the possibility and indeed the plausibility that God has good reasons not to intervene the way we want him to intervene. Now, remember, I said it's plausible. We don't know actuality because we don't know what's in the mind of God. We don't have omniscience. We can't see the consequence of every action down the line, not just in individuals' lives, but across the board and down through history. Okay, but we do have examples. That was just a film example, but we have examples in history where there were terrible things that happened in an instance and later on turned out to result in something unbelievably good in virtue of the terrible circumstance that took place.
Yeah.
And I think of Squanto, for example. Some people know the story there of Squanto and the Mayflower group and the whole thing. I won't go into that, but most Christians have to be honest, who've been around for a while have accounts of this. This terrible thing happened to me. That is, this thing that was terrible in the moment. And I saw how God used it for good. Okay. Yeah. So again, my attempt here is not to exonerate God in every instance where we don't know the good outcome. My point is to say that this kind of objection gets no traction whatsoever about God. And any skeptic that thinks this is a good challenge against a theism of some sort is leaning on a bent reed.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know. Now, it may be that doctors can do this and deal with this problem. How is it that they're capable of doing that? Because human beings are not animals, mere animals. Human beings are in a different class altogether. And according to Christian theology, this makes perfect sense. That humans can cure a disease fits our theology.
Yeah.
Because humans are made in the image of God and capable of doing this kind of thing. And it's their responsibility, to a great degree, to be the hands of God conquering evil in the world, especially the church. So these things fit into our theology nicely. I wonder what, I don't know what the atheist would say. If he's going to be consistent, he'd say, yeah, all this stuff is just stuff. And by the way, if you and I both die and the world dies, then that's not evil. That's just stuff.
Yeah,
it's more
the way
stuff.
That it is.
And if Mother Teresa heals a bunch of people, well, that's just stuff too. That's not good. That's not bad. That's just stuff. That's just things happening because that's all you have in an atheistic universe.
Yeah. The question itself kind of falls apart because there's an oddness to the objection. You know, like we should cure this disease. Well, why? Mm-hmm. It presupposes the value of humans or the necessity or the want for human flourishing. And why do we yearn for human flourishing in the first place? Why aren't we good with corona, the coronavirus, because it's going to save the environment ultimately, because it's going to get rid of all this nasty humans.
Well, it's getting rid of a lot of old folk.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, so we don't have to worry about, taking care of them. On when take. A person could say, well, the reason we should take care of it is because it accrues value to us, interest to us, so out of self-interest. But this, when we actually look at the circumstances of people working hard to deal with something like a viral attack, we are not thinking to ourselves, gee, you know, I'm glad they're doing that because this helps me and this helps them. No, we are saying it helps me and it helps them, and that is a transcendently good thing that they're doing.
Yeah.
So we are not just thinking selfishly here. Our assessment is beyond that, and it acknowledges a higher moral principle that has no place in a materialistic world.
Yeah, and I really, really like how you've, and I've heard it say, you say it so many times, on how you're dealing with the existence of evil in the world. We don't necessarily know that God doesn't have a better, higher purpose for the evil. And I'm always thinking of Joseph.
There you go.
Which is perfect. Genesis.
Right.
It's way late in Genesis 50, I think. And where Joseph says, as for you, you meant evil against me. He's talking to his brothers, and they did horrible things to him that led to a horrible life. But he says, what you meant for evil, God has meant for good. And he goes on to explain why. He even gives the reason why. He says, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. He had all this evil to happen to him, so literally a nation, a people group, would be saved.
That's right.
And he realized that.
The fledgling nation of Israel and all multitudes that were in the area and in the region that were rescued because of the storehousing of the grain that then served the rest of the region during this period of famine.
That's right. Joseph gaining the trust of the Pharaoh and then trusting his visions.
Thank you for bringing Joseph up. I never think of him when I think of these illustrations. I think of Squanto. But Joseph is a much more accessible example right from the text.
Yeah, I love Joseph. All right, so let's dive into Greg Loves to Fish, his question.
That's his name.
A man after your own heart here.
I wonder what he loves to fish for.
He should call
fish,
in.
Fish, but what kind of fish is what I have? Okay.
Well, it could be a discipling thing, right?
That could be,
yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Right.
needs see, a youth pastor or
here
pastor.
I'm just thinking in fleshly terms.
Smallies.
Smallies, yeah, smallmouth bass.
He asked the question, what would you say to someone who says that when John 4 refers to the reaper and the sower refers to John the Baptist and Jesus spreading the gospel first, and the reapers are those who harvested via the gospel later. In both cases, it is preaching of the gospel. And I got to turn there.
Well, John 4 is the woman at the well occasion, and Jesus is in Sychar in Samaria. Jews don't usually travel through that area, but Jesus, it's interesting the way it puts it, he must needs go through Samaria. So he's going from Jerusalem down to Nazareth. I'm sorry, I got my country upside down here. He's going from the south in Jerusalem to the north to the Galilee, and a straight line between Jerusalem and Nazareth would take him through Samaria. People didn't travel that way. They went down to the Jordan River, went up that way because Samaritans were half-breeds, and there was a lot of hostility between Jews. But Jesus went through there, and there's an interesting conversation he has with the woman at the well. Now, I'm very familiar with this passage because I talk a lot about this passage when I discuss the issue of sowing and reaping and gardening and harvesting, okay? And for me, the operative point is that one sows and the other reaps. That's what Jesus said. The proverb is fulfilled that one sows and the other reaps. You are about to reap where you did not sow, is mm-hmm. what he says. So he tells the disciples, somebody else has come before and has done the heavy lifting, you're going to get the low-hanging fruit. You know, you're going to get the easy pickings type thing. But notice in the point I make is he's identifying one field but two seasons.
Yeah.
And that field is Sychar. The seasons are sowing and reaping, gardening and harvesting, and two types of workers, gardeners and harvesters. Okay, and that's the point that I'm making from that passage, which is a really, really important point that I develop, especially in the new edition of Tactics. However, the question here is, well, maybe the one who did the sowing was John the Baptist, and now the disciples are doing the reaping. Isn't that possible? I guess so.
Yeah.
But I have no reason to think that's what's going on here because there's not the slightest reference to John the Baptist. And remember that the Samaritans were half-breeds. They did not. They thought they had a variation of the Jewish religion, and they worshipped in a different place. They didn't interact with Jews at all. This is why the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
Is so profound to the people hearing at the time because the Samaritans and Jews were enemies, but here was the Samaritan doing good to a Jew, even when other Jews didn't do good to that wounded Jewish person. And so it is not likely that these folk are going to travel, these people in this region that is their own region, and they don't mix with Jews, either north or south, are going to travel to the Jordan, wherever it was that John was at, to listen to John. I don't see any reason to believe that. So it's okay to speculate, well, maybe, but if you have no reason to think that's the case, then why impose that in the text in any way? Maybe, maybe not. Since I have no reason to think it, then I'm not going to think it. Maybe it was Philip who went down to see the Ethiopian eunuch, and then maybe the Holy Spirit brought him up to Samaria. I mean, anything possible is possible, but why conjecture like that? The most likely option, it seems to me, is that Jesus is doing the sowing with the woman at Samaria there, the woman at the well, who then goes and tells the rest of the people everything that had happened, a man who told me everything that I know, is this not the Messiah? And then they spend time there, okay? So I would say the most likely candidate is either Jesus and or the woman at the well who are doing the sowing, the reaping to follow by the disciples.
Yeah.
But that makes more sense to me. So principle here, not sure. It's not really that relevant. What's most relevant is the idea that there were sowers and reapers, one field, two seasons, two kinds of workers. And that's the big thing. But if you have to conjecture, try to conjecture with something that makes sense with the text itself and not reach beyond that.
Yeah.
That would be my suggestion.
And what you're saying makes sense in light of, in verse 39, many Samaritans from the town believed in him because the woman's testimony.
Oh, there you go.
So I think there's proof of exactly what you're saying.
Look further. Let's see. So when the Samaritans came to Jesus, they were asking him to stay with them. He stayed with them 2 days, and more believed because of his word.
Yeah.
And they were saying to the woman, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, know that this one is indeed the Savior of the world. That's probably odds-on favorite.
Yeah, I think it's a really good explanation. All right, we're going to try to do another one here. Luke Batty, we have...
I know Luke.
4 minutes. You know
All
Luke?
All right, sure.
Awesome. So, Luke, you're getting your answer question.
Of Batties.
His question is referring to Greg's discussion of human nature in heaven, January 16th. I actually just listened to that.
Oh, okay. You might be better equipped to answer this than me.
If humans,
I can't remember that far back.
I think you'll be okay. If humans will be morally perfect in heaven, then how did Satan fall? If angels are morally innocent in nature, wouldn't that mean they could fall at any time?
Well, moral innocence doesn't mean moral immutability. And what we have with Adam is moral innocence. Yeah. That is, he had no sin. It does not mean he was immutable in that state. And what we had with the angels is moral innocence, because God makes moral creatures morally innocent. He doesn't make them bad. Okay.
Yeah.
Everything God made was good. And so in the case of Satan and apparently one-third of the heavenly realm, evil is found in them in their rebellion in the same way that evil was found in Adam, who was morally innocent but not immutably innocent. This, though, seems to change when we go to heaven. In the resurrection, we are made immutably morally good. That means, as one person put it, hey, in heaven, you can do whatever you want. The thing is, just like God does, he does whatever he wants, but everything that he wants to do is going to be morally sound.
Yeah.
And everything we would want to do is going to be morally sound. And frankly, I don't have all the passages on this and everything, but the standard idea is that the angels who were faithful to God, the two-thirds of the angelic realm, were also made immutably good. And I'm not sure about that, but... regardless of what the state of the angels are, the important thing to keep in mind is the distinction between moral innocence and moral immutability. Okay, God is morally innocent, and he is immutably good.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's his nature. Human beings are made morally innocent. Now, the standard, but then they could fall, which they did, and so after the fall, now they can't do completely good. They can't be sinless. So the classic way of characterizing this is Adam was posse peccare. In other words, it's possible for him to sin, even though he wasn't made a sinner. It's possible. Then after the fall, then it's non posse, non peccare. It's not possible not to sin. All right? And then in heaven, it's my Latin is failing me here, but it is not possible to sin. Okay, non posse peccare. Okay, so we are going to be immutable in heaven, and that's what we're looking forward to.
Yeah,
and that's the way I want it. Frankly,
yes.
I don't want any chances to mess up. You know, but there is a division among Christians about this. Some say we won't sin in heaven, but not because we're morally immutable, but because we choose not to.
Yeah.
So you know, it's a divided field on that one.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good discussion to have. We can't right now, but like, you know, the existence of a free will in heaven, how does this inform us as to will we have a libertarian view of free will?
Yeah, well, God doesn't seem to have that kind of free will, because his nature is such that he does not have the liberty to sin, if one wants to characterize that as a liberty.
Yeah.
And so it's not a vice for God not to have that. It's good that he doesn't have that, and
yes.
So it will be good if we don't have libertarian free will in the sin area. We still will be able to choose things. It isn't either we can sin or we're machines. It's a false dichotomy.
Yeah.
God's not a machine, but he can't sin. So we will, at least arguably, be like him in that regard and have many things that we choose to do, but they will all be proscribed by moral goodness. That is, we're inside the category of that which is morally good, because that will be our natures.
Amen. And we're yearning for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I am, especially today where we are. So that's going to be the end of our STR Ask podcast for today. I just want to make it clear, I'm filling in for Amy Hall, and I'm doing my best. She's amazing. remember that if you submit your questions to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsks, we'd love to answer them for you. My name's John Noyes. I'm filling in for Amy. I'm here with Greg Kokel in the studio, and this is Stand to Reason.